Okay. Revelation 17, starting in verse 15. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." So this is admittedly kind of a puzzling little passage and way to end, chapter 17, because we really don't anticipate this or expect this, the beast turning on the prostitute. That's not the way we would envision this ending. And so, let me just say as sort of a general point that we ought not be too surprised at this betrayal, this disloyalty that we're seeing here between the beast and the ten horns, those kings, those earthly powers, and the woman. Because one of the great points of Revelation that we've made many times, and one that's a great source of comfort for the church, is this idea that God is eternally faithful to those that are his. That's a picture that we see all through Revelation is this constant theme of God's faithfulness, his loyalty to those that are his. God's redemptive plan for fallen man is one that really centers and hinges on his perfect fidelity to the elect. Without that, the redemptive plan would fail. And so as we read, these difficult and some that we've seen already disturbing passages that picture judgment, again, we can take comfort in knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that we as his people will never, ever, ever be the objects of his wrath. So that's going to be the contrast to what we're seeing unfolding in this picture. The dragon, in contrast, Satan has set up this whole copycat relationship and laid it out before the world to latch onto. If you will, he's offered his own redemptive plan to the world. And he uses every available means to entice and seduce men and women to sign on to his plan and to enter into this relationship with him. But what we see is that unlike our God, Satan has absolutely no capacity for faithfulness. It's not part of what he is and who he is. Infidelity is at the core of his being. And so, we ought not be surprised that in our passage that we're looking at now that we see him turning on his own. That's what's happening. He's making his own the object of his wrath and his anger. That very thing that we said God will never do, to his own. This is Satan's anger being displayed through the beast in this case, but it's anger and its wrath that up to this point has been reserved for Christ. It's been anger reserved and aimed at Christ and the church. And we've seen over and over again that that's not going to succeed. And at some point, how is he going to express that anger? He's going to turn on his own. And that's what we're starting to see here as we get into this description of the fall of Babylon, this sort of unraveling of all of this. And, when you think about it, betrayal as a concept has been part of world history and politics forever. The famous stories of Caesar and Brutus and all those the history is just replete with all of those examples. In fact, I think there's far more stories about betrayal in history than there are great stories of how one was loyal to another. I mean, those are kind of rare moments in history where we see loyalty, and even then, the loyalty that we see is transient. You know, loyalty never seems to be, permanent. You know, that old expression in American politics, or at least in military circles, that America has no permanent allies and no permanent enemies. You just don't know from year to year, you know, who's going to be, we're going to be in favor with. And so, you know, if I'm being honest, with what I see in this passage, this is actually more satisfying to me personally to see it unravel this way than just to read that God one day destroyed the system. You know, there's something about it turning on itself, it exposing itself that way. You know, we would say that this is poetic justice, you know, if you will. And, you know, maybe that says something bad about me that I like, you know, that little bit of vindication. But there is something that's especially sweet about that form of justice. I mean, let's be honest, we like that. In all the crazy politics going on, I mean, what would you, regardless of your party affiliation, would you rather just see the opposing party defeated on election day and that's the end of it, or would you rather see your opposing party completely implode on itself and then lose? You know, that's kind of what we're, you know, that's, let's be honest. And that is what's taking place here. You know, that opposing party of God is imploding on itself. You know, the world system begins to, I think here, reveal its true nature as it unravels. In verse 16, we read, "And the 10 horns that you saw," remember back to that picture at the beginning of 17, "the 10 horns that you saw associated with the beast, they and the beast together will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled." Did you catch that last part of that? You know, we're thinking about the prostitute being destroyed and burned and all of those things. But this last part is really something, that God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose. And, you know, I think that this is the kind of statement that ought to give us great, confidence and comfort in all of this. I read a story, some of you may have too, it floated around, I think Facebook is where I saw it this week. It was written by an evangelist in California. I don't remember his name. But he was really, in this article, he was belittling Christians and actually berating some Christians who are approaching this election cycle with the attitude that, well, God's on his throne and that's it. And, you know, he says that that God works through people. But the problem is, and he's right there to an extent, but what he goes on to really suggest in the article is that God works exclusively through people, and somehow the burden is on us to make something good happen. Now, I believe that we ought to be good citizens, especially as Christians, to promote our faith, our values, and to push them when we get a chance. But it is not on us. This election is not on us, and I'm quite comfortable resting solely in the fact that God is on his throne. That's no small thing, and at the end of the day, we really have to rest on this. I don't think it's a cop-out, and I don't think it's something that we ought to be ashamed of. But as I, and of course, everybody loved this article for some reason, and I just, you know, that's just one of those things about social media that drives you crazy, is you see Christians agreeing and amening with stuff that you want to say, wait a second, look at it carefully. You know, it's not something that we really want to say amen to. But as I look at this final section, these final verses, I think that the main point, there it goes. the main point in this may not actually be the destruction of the woman. That's certainly a central feature of this, but I really think that the fact that God makes it absolutely clear that he has orchestrated this, he has orchestrated her demise by essentially unleashing the evil that already existed within these. You know, he worked in their hearts. It's not that God has made them evil, and it's not even that he's making them do these things, but we're told that he has worked in their hearts and essentially no longer restraining the evil that exists in those hearts. And really the result is they reveal themselves for what they are. You know, the beast shows his true colors. He's not loyal. And so when the text says that he put it into their hearts to do this, I think the way we ought to read that and see that is that that's an act of judgment on his part. He has judged the beast by working in their hearts and leading them to do this. And again, that's, for me, that's sweet justice. You know, that's just something that is satisfying to me. You know, God is exposing them for what they are, but he does it by causing them to reveal themselves, which I find fascinating. It's sort of an amazing thought that when we see, you know, those in power self-destruct, you know, and in our lifetimes, we've seen politicians and powerful people in different arenas of life self-destruct. You know, we've seen it. Sometimes it's pitiful. Sometimes we sort of cheer at it. But, I think this passage reminds us that, you know, we may be actually seeing the very hand of God. This is a part of how he works and how he reveals evil for what it is, this sort of unraveling. So for me, you know, it kind of challenges me to see the hand of God working in ways that I may not have really thought about it. So it's a thought-provoking thing, to say the least. And, you know, I suppose maybe I'm just making way too much of this detail, but I really don't think so. Anyway, as I said a few minutes ago, there seems to be an Old Testament connection here, which should not surprise us based on what we've seen so far in Revelation. But this time, the Old Testament connection is with the nation of Israel. Israel was betrothed to Yahweh. There was to be a marriage there in the Old Testament, but most of the Old Testament is what? It's a chronicle of her infidelity. It's not a pretty picture of that divine marriage, that is part of God's plan for his people. Israel was God's trophy. She was his witness, his representation on the earth, but she over and over and over again exchanged that relationship for infidelity with the nations. She was repeatedly seduced by the nations and became a seducer herself. Okay, she's not pictured as a victim in any of this. Quite the opposite. She becomes a picture, and this is the Old Testament language, she becomes a picture of a prostitute. The Old Testament language refers to her activity as whoring. You know, it's not pretty. And there's a lot of passages here, but I'm gonna read a few verses, if I can, from Ezekiel 23. And you don't have to turn there, but if you want to look at this on your own during the week, Ezekiel 23 is a very interesting and lengthy passage here. I'm going to just pick out some verses here, starting in 25. And this is just so that you see the language that's used here. And I will direct my jealousy against you, that they may deal with you in fury. They shall cut off your nose and your ears, and your survivors shall fall by the sword. they shall seize your sons and daughters, and your survivors shall be devoured by fire. This is God pronouncing judgment on adulterous Israel. They shall also strip you of your clothes. You know, we've already seen a couple parallels. They'll be devoured by fire, stripped of their clothes. They will be naked. And take away your beautiful jewels. Thus I will be putting an end to your lewdness and your whoring begun in the land of Egypt. This infidelity started long ago, so that you shall not lift up your eyes to them or remember Egypt anymore. Let me jump down to 47. And the host shall stone them and cut them down with their sword. They shall kill their sons and daughters and burn up their houses. Then I will put an end to lewdness in the land, and all women may take warning and not commit lewdness as you have done. And they shall return your lewdness upon you, and you shall bear the penalty for your sinful idolatry, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So that's a rough passage for Israel. And please don't understand me in what I'm saying here. In this Old Testament language, I'm not suggesting that Israel of old, that this woman in Revelation represents Israel. That's not a connection that I'm trying to make in any kind of prophetic sense. So be clear on that. But there are some that have suggested. I may take you up on that. Forgive me for talking with something in my mouth, but I may not be talking if I don't. There are some who have suggested that the similarity in language between these Old Testament passages and what we see in Revelation indicates that the harlot of Babylon that we're looking at here must be the New Testament counterpart to apostate Israel in the Old Testament. So this would identify her in Revelation as being the apostate church. Now, I do think that the woman in Revelation represents more than just the apostate church. I don't think we can say the woman is the apostate church, but I think the apostate church is a very central part of the woman, and it's a part that as Christians we're specifically and especially concerned with. And so the crass language of prostitution that we see, I think it communicates several things to us. First of all, this language is really an indictment of the legitimacy of the relationships involved. You know, the relationship of a person with a prostitute is not a legitimate relationship. You know, nothing is real. There may be the appearance of intimacy. There may even be the appearance of love in this. But what we find out is that this is but an illusion. This is not real, because at the end of the day, she's a prostitute. Okay, so it's a reality check. And I think, second, in the case of Israel and you know, the church apostate in the New Testament, we have this sad reality that they did possess the real thing at some point, and they exchanged it for that which is fake. They had the real deal and they exchanged it for a prostitute. They threw away their marriages, you know, for a prostitute. No matter how well things appear to be going in this world for those who are entrenched in it, and it often does, it's not going to end well. Because at the end of the day, their relationship, that thing that may be making things look really good, is built on infidelity. It's a relationship with a prostitute. So I think that's the kind of the heart and soul of why all of this language of prostitution. And I look at the mainline American churches, you know, and I don't really have a feel for what's going on worldwide. You know, every country has its own relationship with its churches, and the state of the churches are different countries. So really all I can do is comment on the American church. And we see, now I'm talking about the mainline churches. I'm talking about, you know, the mainline Lutherans, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, not all of those. We would not consider ourselves part of the mainline church. But I think we're pretty, you know, familiar with the truth that these mainline churches generally support, you know, the agenda of the homosexual community, pretty much across the board. It's not even a matter of tolerance. It's a matter of welcoming. And you know, we have homosexual clergy and all of these sorts of things. Abortion rights, you know, pretty much across the board, that they have bought into this idea that there is something that trumps life, and that's choice, which is a complete denial of God's authority. You know, this idea that we're so autonomous, that what matters above everything is a woman's right to choose. It reveals much about, you know, about someone's view of God. But we have churches that are embracing Islam. And again, even beyond just tolerating it, they're saying it's not that different. It's, you know, it's something that we can even partner with. And you know, those sorts of things. But the point is that as they do this, as these mainline churches, you know, support these agendas, things go well for them in society. They're not suffering. They're not the object of politicians, you know, that see them as a threat. You know, they see us as a threat. They see the evangelical church as a threat. But, you know, this has made things pretty good. This relationship has made things pretty good for the mainline churches. In fact, government often sees such churches as partners in their agenda. You know, us, on the other hand, we're bigots. You know, they're thoughtful, we're intolerant. But it's not just the church. You know, social organizations like Planned Parenthood. And I'm getting into this not to be overtly political about it, but this is really what the text is addressing. You know, these organizations like Planned Parenthood that support the government agenda, as a result, they're fiercely protected. I mean, if you've ever watched the news, you're aware of that. They're not only protected, they're empowered. They're emboldened by government, and we see it, and it drives us crazy. But the message here in these last verses of Revelation 17, you know, tell us that these unions, these alliances that you know, exist in our society, represented by the woman riding on the back of the beast, that's you know, represents these alliances. Revelation 17 tells us that even in the best of cases, this is going to end badly for the woman and all who she represents, because earthly powers will one day turn on themselves. And it's not that the beast is going to be reformed someday, and that's when the beast turns on the woman. That's not the case at all. It is a matter of hate. There is such hatred that is at the root of, you know, let's say the world system, the beast. There's such hatred that even its allies are not safe. You know, and when you contrast this perverse relationship and dynamic with what we have with our God, it's astounding, you know, to think that they trade what we have, what they can have, for this, because of the appearance of things, you know, going well. This brings up a question that we'll address more in chapter 18. And that is, as we get into 18, we see these pictures of mourning over the fall of the woman. And so you have to ask the question, if the beast and those in power now hate her and have turned on her and purpose to destroy her, why do we see these expressions of mourning over her in chapter 18? You know, and I think that what we'll see is that after turning on the woman, there is a realization that sets in for some, that this woman is what made things go well for them. It talks about the merchants you know, mourning over her. Her seductiveness is part of what made the economic system go. And when they turn on her, they suffer. And all of a sudden they realize, what have we done, you know, to ourselves? So there's that sort of thing happening here. But we'll get into that. And, you know, it's almost like they didn't realize how dependent they were on the woman in this relationship until they turned on her. But let me back up and look at verse 15, where all of this began in our text this morning. I'm jumping around a lot, I know. The angel now says to John, the waters that you saw, you know, she was described in his vision as the prostitute who was seated on many waters. Remember that description? So the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. Remember, the angel is in the explanatory mode right now. He's told John he's going to explain all those things, and he's still doing that. And this is a pretty important interpretation that the angel gives. And so let's not get lost here as we start to approach chapter 18 and the fall of Babylon the Great. The woman that we've been talking about, seeing and referring to, she is Babylon the Great. Okay, they're the same. If you remember, we were told back in verse 5 that her name was written on her forehead, and that name is Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes, and of earth's abominations. Okay, so she is Babylon the Great. That's what we're talking about here. We're not moving from the woman to Babylon the Great in chapter 18. So just keep that point straight. But here's my point in this, is that in the Old Testament, and if you remember past discussions, we saw that the historic Babylon, the historic city of Babylon, was said to be, you know, seated on many waters. And we talked about the fact that there were all these channels and aquifers from the Euphrates River that tunneled in under walls and fed the city, and in a real sense gave her life. And all of these channels of water in many ways allowed Babylon to flourish. And if you remember, that was also her downfall, because Cyrus, king of Persia, did what? He diverted that water, drained those aquifers and channels, and his soldiers came in through those passages, and judgment was you know, meted out on Babylon. The city is destroyed, and just as important, more importantly, God's people were rescued. Remember, the Israelites who were captive for 70 years were also rescued in that invasion through these watery channels. So this was, if you want to refresh your memory, that was all from the sixth trumpet that we saw. But now we have this interesting shift in the language. So that's the historic Babylon seated on many waters. But the language that's used here is of a New Testament Babylon, if you will. The angel says that the waters on which Babylon, the woman, sits, represents something different. They represent peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So this clearly tells us, you know, we hear talk in the prophecy world about the revived Roman Empire, or the revived Babylon. There's a revived Roman Empire, you know, and people talk about the revival of Babylon as well. But here we see that this Babylon, in the New Testament sense, is global in its scope. This is not a city. This is not something where something's going to be rebuilt at the site of old Babylon and or anything like that. This is something very global. When we see these expressions, peoples and multitudes and nations and languages, that's the language of universality, you know, of something being global. And, you know, when we talk about the beast, the woman, Babylon the Great, I think we, at least I do, we may be tempted to think of this in kind of impersonal terms. You know, like the way we might talk about the political machine, you know, expressions like that, or even our government. You know, we almost imagine the government as being an actual thing, And it's not. I mean, the government is a collection of people. Every government is. Just like a political machine. We're really talking about a collection of politicians. That's the political machine. So, but we sort of think a little impersonally. And, you know, we have to remember that in any, you know, given time, as I said, all of these institutions are really just the sum of the people that make them up. And so Babylon the Great, we're told now, is built on the people of this world. That is Babylon the Great. It's not a third party. You know, it's not something we can't... It's the people is what it is. And it's a pretty clear interpretation that the angel gives. And so when we read in verse 16 that the 10 horns or powers of this world turn on the prostitute because of hatred, this is ultimately just people turning on people is what it is. That's why I say, you know, be wary of impersonalizing this. This is people turning against people. And you know, we see this play out over history. And we see many examples of this happening. Think about, you know, all the dictators that have come to power that when you read the history of how that happened, largely the people facilitate the rise of a dictator. They in many cases they put the dictator in power. The dictator then does what? Turns around and oppresses the people and kills them, you know, and does not become their friend. So, you know, that's just a kind of a glimpse of the dynamic that I think all of this is referring to. And it's telling us there's coming a day, though, that sort of thing is going to happen on a much larger scale. But it happens continuously. It is part of history and how things happen. So this is a historical pattern. But, you know, finally, we're reminded in verse 18 that the woman that John saw is, in fact, the great city, you know, Babylon, that has dominion over the kings of the earth. You know, all that she represents has had power over all of earth's leaders. You know, in these passages, all kings are not necessarily lumped in together. You know, this idea of the 10 horns represents a group of kings, not necessarily 10 of them, but there are and have been pretty decent world leaders from time to time. So it's they're not all lumped into this. So, you know, when it talks about the 10 horns, we're talking about leaders, kings, rulers who are in lockstep with the beast. But in this last section in verse 18, when it says she has dominion over the kings, I think that's a broader statement, and that says even in the good examples, in a nation where things might be doing okay and they've got a reasonably good leader, the fact remains that her influence, no one escapes that. There's no society that has ever been free of these kind of influences. You know, seduction, infidelity, idolatry. I hate to say it, but it's sort of the backbone of government. And that's a pretty grim statement about our world, but I think our experience in history and what we see right before our eyes kind of confirms that it's a fact. You know, the dragon, Satan, has built this world system. It is a reflection of its you know, creator, if you will. But again, this passage reminds us that God ultimately rules even this system, this nasty, idolatrous, perverse system, and God can bring it down at any moment. He can work in the hearts of these people. And so that is a comforting thing.
The leaders have no idea that they would be held accountable at some point for their actions.
No. I mean, that's the nature of power blinds them. Yeah. Yeah, that is the nature of the power of this world. So, just this last week, I almost hesitate to even bring this up, but I'm going to do it anyways. Just this past week, I saw this pattern develop that made me think of this idea of turning on one another as the FBI reopened this Clinton investigation. And I have no idea where that investigation's going. That's not my point at all. But what's interesting to me is that the media personalities and the media outlets that have championed her and frankly have been willing to ignore what looks pretty bad. I mean, evidence that the average person and legal experts say is pretty bad. They've been overlooking those things, instantly are saying some pretty harsh things about her. You know, people that Chris Matthews, he made a statement that said that this is who she is, and even if she wins, she's going to continue to sell the bedrooms in the White House. I'm like, why did you not say anything even remotely akin to that before this came out? And again, to me, it was just sort of this glimpse of how quickly people turn on people. People who seem to be in cahoots can turn on each other. And I don't know if anybody's getting brought down in this. I'm not. You get my point. It's just, it happens that fast. And I just flipping through some channels, MSNBC, CNN, you saw it on all of them. There was somebody that just shocked you that they were, for the first time, saying bad things about somebody that they have been pushing. I don't know how far that will go, but anyway, I think that you know, many of us are just frustrated by this when we look at the media. And again, this is one of these relationships that I'm talking about. The relationship of media to government has become one of these perverse relationships. It's not any different than Planned Parenthood and government or the apostate church and government. It's all the same thing. And I think we get pretty frustrated when we see these relationships because they look absolutely unbreakable. I mean, it doesn't look like the media will, you know, 50 years from now, we'll be talking about a, you know, conservative media or anything. It just doesn't seem like that can happen. But just like the bond between the woman and the beast was broken, God can break any of these bonds. None of this stuff is permanent. We just don't know from day to day, and it can happen fast. You know, it's not like we have to say, well, we'll never see it in our lifetime. You don't know. You don't know how things can change quickly for the worse. They can change quickly for the better. So it's hopeful to me to just know that our God is so sovereign over these things. A lot of people have this idea that you know, God watches over his church and he orchestrates good things for his church, but this nasty stuff, he keeps his hands out of that. That's just not the truth. It's not the truth at all. He works in the hearts and the minds of these people. It may be an act of judgment, his doing so, but nothing is hands off for God. We need to remind ourselves of that constantly, or all of this political stuff will drive us nuts. But, you know, God can reveal what needs to be revealed. You know, that's what we really want. We believe there's all these truths that need to be revealed. God can reveal those quickly. Maybe he has begun to. I don't know. I'm not going that far. But, you know, as I said, he's not restricted to working in the hearts of only those who know and love him. So I'm not suggesting that our current politics is the fulfillment of any of this. That's not what I'm saying. I don't really do that. But I've said from the beginning, what I am saying, though, is that the prophetic principles that we're seeing, which I think are more important than figuring out the how things are fulfilled, the prophetic principles that we see throughout Revelation really are at play in front of us. We can read this, and we can see these dynamics happening. I think people 200, 300, 1,000 years ago could have also read this and seen this playing out in front of them. And I've said from the beginning of Revelation that this book ought to transform our thinking in terms of our worldview, or which is how we understand our world. If we can't study Revelation, we ought not study Revelation and walk away not having a better understanding of our world. That's really the only, you know, goal in that sense. And I do think we can. I think it gives us a much better set of glasses in which to look around and understand what's going on and not be undone by it. You know, there are some people that can look around, see what's going on. That's not the end of it. You need to also understand God's role, that He's sovereign. You need to be comforted by that. You need to be strengthened by that and have confidence in that. Just to see things as they are, you know, without that peace, yeah, that's the most unnerving thing I can think of. But to know that God is capable of working in the hearts and minds of these people for His own purposes is pretty powerful. You know, we also understand from Revelation that there are some pretty powerful forces at play in all of this. This is not just flesh and blood. This is not just powerful people. We see this very clearly. We knew this before this study, but I hope we've really, you know, have seen it on display here. We see these powerful forces at play, but one thing we don't see in Revelation is at no time in any of these episodes that we've read about is God anything less than absolutely sovereign. It doesn't matter what it is, there is something put into that text that reminds us of his sovereignty. At no point is Christ's church unprotected. At no point are things out of control. That's a big thing to take from the study. And I think that's part of the reason, you know, that Revelation has a special blessing that's promised at the beginning of the book. You know, for those that essentially take this very seriously, there's a blessing. We don't see that in other books. And it's so serious, and I've read this before, that when we get to the end of the book, there is a dire warning about those who would alter or that would mess with this. So it's serious stuff. So we come now to the chapter 18. Obviously, we're not going to really get into it. And as I've mentioned before, I think it ought to get our attention that so much text is dedicated to the fall of Babylon. I feel like we've already seen a good bit about the fall of Babylon, but now in a very large chapter, 18 is going to really expand it and kind of show us the effects of this unraveling. It's a very important chapter dedicated to the demise of Babylon and all that it represents. And, you know, the promise of the fall of Babylon is not left to a few obscure verses, you know, that we interpret as the fall. This is so clear. This is so crystal clear. We don't have to really sweat, you know, interpretation very much. There's no question on this issue as to how the world system ends. And, you know, some take great issue with much of what I've said and I'm going to say, and they would say that this is a pessimistic view of history, you know, that God will transform government and all of these sorts of things. And I understand those viewpoints. And of course, for those that believe that this world system is going to be reformed and reshaped and brought into accord with His word and His law, they would say, yeah, that your view is very pessimistic. But I disagree, because when I look at the same thing that they might call pessimistic, what I see is God at work making all things right. Now, how He makes it right is different in my view than you know, theirs perhaps. And yes, it involves exercising divine judgment to make things right. But Christ is preserving. He's building a church in the midst of all of this, which is an amazing thing. We're told that nothing can interfere with that. And so I think I'm just about as optimistic as a person can be. I know God is going to make this right. The details of it, we can debate, we can, you know, but, you know, some people say that you could sum Revelation up into just saying we win, you know. Yeah, but it's, if I were going to sum it up a little bit better, I would say it's in that God will make all things right, as they should be. So that's a pretty optimistic thing, you know. I was going to read some of chapter 18, but it's time and my voice has had it.